And welcome to Open Finance, the podcast that believes the future of financial services is open, brought to you by Finastra. I'm your host, Emily Nicole, tech editor of City AM, and today my guests and I are discussing whether banking innovation is more than a cost-cutting exercise. With me today is Charlotte Crosswell, CEO of Innovate Finance, the independent membership association that represents the UK's global fintech community. Hi Charlotte, how are you?
Hi Emily, good, thank you.
And we're also joined by Simon Paris, CEO of Finastra, the fintech that unlocks the potential of people and businesses everywhere through their platform for open innovation. Hi Simon, how are you?
Hi Emily, good to be here, thank you.
Great. So clearly cost is a factor in banking innovation, adapting to compete with asset-light market challenges while also increasing efficiency. But if not cost, what is the biggest driver of investment into innovation, Simon?
Yeah, so innovation, the reason for innovation is to delight the end customers. So when we think about what triggers it, it's obviously an opportunity or solving a problem or a response to a need. And yes, it needs to be funded. So does it come through cost cutting or does it come through deliberate investment? It needs to be funded for sure.
And what are you kind of seeing in how that's playing out? Where's the funding coming from at the moment?
Yeah, so from multiple sources. So there's everything from angel investors through early venture capital to more established private equity to the banks themselves. Or there are people like ourselves in the software space, in the technology space, or other players like Microsoft who have vehicles for this. So there's a lot of funding and let's call it smart capital available.
And Charlotte, why do you think banks are placing such an importance on innovation and doing these cost-cutting measures?
I think we've seen a significant change, you know, since the financial crisis of 2008, which is really what triggered the change and the drive for innovation. So yes, some of that was for cost cutting. And I think, you know, for a cynic, they would say that that was the main driver at the beginning. You know, what you see now is that's opened up the market for more competition in financial services. So the banks have realised that they have to innovate themselves. And innovation teams are springing up all over the place within the financial services institutions now. And then obviously you've had these newcomers, the fintech companies, also starting to say, right, we're either going to compete, you know, we're going to disrupt, or we're going to partner and bring in some very interesting solutions to some of the large institutions. And those lines are blurring an incredible amount now. So yes, there is cost cutting available for the banks, but it's a lot more than that now. You know, it's full embracing of technology, as you say, Simon, to the end consumer, who is ultimately the one that benefits. And then we have to watch out what's happening on big tech as they enter the financial services space and what cost cutting they're going to be able to bring because they have the scale there already.
And we've seen that happen recently with Facebook entering the payment sphere. We've also talked on other platforms about Amazon and their loan book expanding rapidly as well. But so to what extent do you think consumers are driving that rather than big tech or the heads of those businesses?
You know, I believe a lot of the innovation at the beginning came to the end consumer, so it's B2C. It is more challenging, you know, the B2B side of innovation because you have to get through the procurement phases of the banks, and I know Finastra, you know, has a huge business on the back of that. You know, so we have to work out how we actually bring that innovation through. How do you sit there and get banks to, you know, approve this new technology when they have balance sheet requirements, they have, you know, procurement processes that have been in place for some time. But certainly the end consumer is the one that's going to benefit from this disruption, whether that's B2C directly or more likely B2B2C.
No, you just triggered a thought that one of the things that's very exciting about innovation right now is that the cost to innovate and the speed to innovate has dramatically fallen. So it used to be 10, 15 years ago, if you wanted to start a company or start an initiative, you'd need to start with $50,000, $60,000 of capital. Now you can start with just a few thousand dollars of capital and you don't need any IT technology. You can spin it up on the cloud instantly. So the barrier to entry, both in terms of cost and speed, for rapid cycle innovation has really, really lowered. And that's also igniting, I think. And then you think about, you know, how you can co-locate large data sets with infinite compute as that technology has progressed. You can do things which a few years ago were very, very hard to do. Hence the birth of AI and ML and NLP and all these acronyms we love.
And so with the kind of market of financial services changing rapidly, even day on day sometimes it seems like, why do we think that these big tech players are now getting into the business of banking?
When you look at the scale they have, and if you're over in the States, they'll call it TechFin rather than FinTech. You know, they have that scale. They have the customer base in place. Now, what they have to work out is, do they want to be regulated? Do they want to be a financial institution, or are they just going to provide that technology solution? But if you look at some of these new players coming into the market, they're trying to get their new products in place, which is why they go to a lot of partnerships, is incredibly hard. You are literally sitting there signing up one customer at a time. You know, now some of them would say they're signing up, you know, a few thousand at a time, but it's still quite slow. If you take a Facebook, you know, their recent announcement, you know, they have 2.7 billion customers already using a Facebook product. So, you know, if they do decide to go into that payment space and into, you know, into financial services, they have that customer base already, and then they have to work out what the future looks like.
But there we also have a perception issue, right? I think if we are saying that consumers are at the beginning and end of all of this, and because they're the ones that will use the products and drive the growth, a lot of the complaints around Facebook getting involved in payments with its Libra cryptocurrency coin, whatever you'd like to call it, is that Facebook is a company that has gone through some troubles in recent years. It doesn't necessarily have the consumer trust and the good perception that banks do. Do you think that's going to be a stumbling block for not just Facebook, but also other big tech giants looking to innovate here?
So I think if you look at the problem they're trying to solve, right? So why does a payment cost so much to make? Or why does it cost so much to exchange currency? So if you look at the problem they're trying to solve, they won't solve it uniquely. Everybody else will catch up with them. They will increase competition, to Charlotte's point, and all players will have to play at that game. It doesn't mean consumers are locked into a Facebook currency only. Everyone else will have to match the new standard, the new capability, not the currency, the coin, but the ability for low cost.
But do you think banks can effectively do that? We often hear chat about how banks are stuck on legacy architecture. They're struggling to innovate as fast as fintechs because they're bundled down by all this heavy traditional thinking. Do you think they're going to be able to catch up with Facebook and actually make it less of a unique product and therefore increase the competition?
I mean, I think for me, that's where the industry is so exciting at the moment. You've seen this disruption come from the fintechs who are able to show a different type of culture, different type of product. You know, they're only doing their niche product. They're not having to provide all the banking services. And to a certain extent, you know, 5 years ago, the banks were really struggling to keep up with that, sitting there putting their Shoreditch hubs in place to ensure that they could sit there and, you know, have some relationship with fintech companies or at least watch what they're doing. What you're now seeing, of course, is banks in there and actually bring those solutions to market themselves. Either, you know, was through partnership, now actually building out their own products. They're starting to hire people from fintech companies themselves as well. So I think, you know, banks are racing to get there. She said there's legacy systems in place. I don't think that's changing, you know, rapidly enough, probably for their liking. But the innovation teams themselves, you know, they are now sitting in head office. They're not necessarily sitting separately. So I think, you know, everyone recognises here in the UK that, you know, we are quite advanced compared to the rest of the world, that the financial services institutions themselves have recognised they can't be complacent, they can't wait. And, you know, and I think it's a bit of a race against time of can they sit there and either build those partnerships or build themselves before potentially, you know, they have threat from some of the big tech firms.
If you look at other industries, you can also see where it might go. So if you look at, for example, Amazon, when they launched in 98 or whenever it was, everyone said this is the death of the bookstore. And then all of a sudden the bookstores had to innovate or die. So they start offering coffee and book readings and book signings and we'll help select for you and make it more of an environment. Or take the car industry. Everyone said the electric car, Tesla, is going to kill everybody. Everybody else started to catch up. Volvo have now, you know, just signed a deal for 25,000 cars with Uber. Right. So I think everyone will get to the best standard very quickly.
Charlotte, you spoke about how the UK is really the standout winner here. We've got a great example of how fintechs and banks can collaborate with each other, but also force each other to compete and innovate as a result. How do we see the US factoring into that? Do you think banks over there are doing well at also chiming in with fintechs? Sorry for the pun, but chime being one.
I mean, you know, I think in the US it's a very different environment in terms of fintech adoption. So the banks, yes, absolutely, are they sit there and innovating? Yes, they are. You haven't necessarily got the regulatory environment that lends itself so much to innovation. If you look at what the FCA did, you know, here in the UK, it was all about the sandbox, and so many people copied that sandbox idea, and now they've taken it one step forward with GFIN, you know, the global network, to try to see what things we can put onto a global sandbox. That's quite forward thinking for a regulator. It's quite forward thinking to have someone who's there, you know, responsible for competition and strategy for a regulator, and to have a team that actually helps companies get going with data in a safe environment. Compared to the US, you know, obviously huge fragmentation of regulator, depending whether you're federal or state, which way do you go, who do you go to. And then you look at the geographical proximity, you know, and I don't think we should underestimate the power of that. You've obviously got huge investment coming in from the West Coast. You've got obviously the VCs sitting there. You've got some of the tech companies there. But financial services is fragmented. It's sitting over in the East Coast or in Chicago. And then regulators sitting down DC and across the rest of the states. So I think that doesn't lend itself as well to some of the ecosystem, you know, connections that we have here in the UK. You don't have to go far from here to be within 20 minutes of government or the regulators or the fintech companies or the providers, the vendors or the banks.
Simon, with your experience of the US banking structures, how do you think that lends itself or doesn't lend itself to innovation?
Yeah, so building on what Charlotte was saying, you know, the US is not one country, it's 50, right? So it is one more problem to be solved. And the way to solve the problem is, how do you connect innovator with consumer? And what changes is, you can't do that in a 20-minute radius. You have to do that through a platform-based approach. So all of the, you know, approximately 10,000 financial institutions in the US, you can't go and call them one by one. So a platform-based approach that brings innovators that can be distributed to those consumers and make the regulatory compliance at their local level or at the appropriate level is the only way to solve that problem. And that's the approach we're taking there.
But we've even seen examples of where US banks have attempted to innovate and failed recently. JP Morgan launched their banking app last year, Finn by Chase, which was meant to be a Monzo-esque digital bank for millennials mostly to be using and seeing how that could work in the US market. And they've now recently shut that effort down. What do you think was the main inhibitor for that?
I think you've had a lot more fragmentation in banks in the US for a very long time. I think the fact that we've had so few banking licences were created here in the UK and that dominates the high street banks, it made it a little easier for some of these new challenger banks and some of the foreign, you know, the foreign exchange providers to sit there and say, we can do better than that. We can sit there and get there faster. Whereas that fragmentation across the US of banks starting, banks stopping, has meant it's a little more difficult to work out what the consumers want. Whereas here, you don't have to go to many banks and say, OK, I know how I'm going to innovate. I know how I'm going to compete. That's the service I'm going to offer. And we haven't really seen enough innovation here in the UK, pre-financial crisis. And now, of course, it's a race to who gets there first.
And in the UK as well, we've seen government get involved in particular, obviously. Like we said at the beginning, it was partly in response to the financial crash in 2008, but with initiatives like the RBS Remedies Fund, deliberately trying to stimulate competition in this space by giving money to mostly younger companies, and some of them even incredibly software-led, in order to kind of speed up innovation but also increase competition in the market. How successful do you think that's been, and what has it done to increase innovation with traditional banks?
Yeah, I mean, a UK environment which you help foster, which sparks innovation at speed by encouraging a safe and simple regulatory environment and easy access to capital and attracting the right kind of talent and providing the right access to data and distribution, the UK is doing a lot of things very well. So I think some of the things you just referred to will just continue that flywheel effect.
I mean, as you say, though, Simon, it is about eventually going digital. Mm. Yeah, at the moment, as I said, it's almost the physical meetups. It's interesting, even when you get out of London, we haven't seen so many of the companies setting up outside of London. Ideas are coming from there, but they're bringing those down to London.
And so often when we talk about innovation, we almost always assume it's the job of fintechs to be expanding out of London and bringing digital to those consumers. But actually, I mean, banks are already there. What can those banks do to overcome their old ways of thinking and try and bring a digital mix to what the infrastructure they've already got?
Mm. So Charlotte and I were talking earlier about culture. This is probably a good segue into culture. So if you want to encourage innovation, one thing the Americans do incredibly well compared to us Brits or Europeans is celebrate failure. Right? So if you fail on the West Coast, it's referred to as a badge of honour. And in fact, you can go to a drinks party and say, hey, I have 3 badges of honour. I failed 3 times, and I know why I'm going to succeed on the 4th time. We have a little bit more of a stigma here. So that culture to encourage failure, to fail fast, to pay for the learning, constant experimentation, is a culture I think banks, technology firms, software providers, regulators can encourage. It needs to be safe, needs to be regulated, of course, but it's a culture that we should probably look to propagate.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I love the fact now you have failure weeks in schools. Mm-hmm. That they sit there and they encourage kids to sit there and realise that failure is not a bad thing. And whether that's going to have the impact of the innovators and entrepreneurs of the future.
And so I guess then the final thing to consider is, what can governments do to help all of this along? Obviously, Charlotte, you've got lots of experience of this, rolling your eyes in this room. But with the challenges of Brexit and also regulatory environments and all the challenges that that brings, if we're also thinking about how we need to be utilising more of what the UK has to offer, as a lot of our windows arguably are beginning to close, what can banks be doing to really try and make sure they make the most of the UK?
I certainly think we're going to go through a change in regulatory system. We've been very open to innovation and disruption, and you're starting to see the regulators now start to adopt a little bit more stricter approach to that. That's not a bad thing. We have to make sure post-financial crisis that it is a level playing field while embracing innovation as well. I think it's fascinating going through the last 3 years since the Brexit vote. And so many people say to me, well, what's government doing on this? Why is government not involved? Why are they not at the table? It's probably because they're quite busy doing something else. But you could argue during that last 3 years, I've never seen industry be as collaborative and sitting there working together. When I look around my table, I have the banks there, I have the fintech companies there, I have the regulators as observers. We invite government in if they want to from time to time. But actually, you know, industry driving this together is actually, you could argue, getting to a faster place than before, where we would have almost asked for permission. And you know, when you, as long as you keep government informed, so this is the way we want to see it, this is what we're recommending, or these are some of the trends we're seeing, I think they're incredibly grateful for that. But I think they don't want to be seen as the ones who have to do stuff to make the next evolution happen. Because you could argue that that can come from industry. And I think industry's got so much better at working together. I mean, you take cultural change, you take the work that, I know Finastra is doing in schools. That doesn't need government endorsement, doesn't need Department for Education change. It's just something industry is doing themselves. So I think we've got to a good place now where you've got industry saying, we just have to get on with it. We can't afford to wait. And let's just keep people informed. Let's make sure the regulators sit at the table so they understand the trends. And you could argue that we're succeeding incredibly well, despite some political headwinds at the moment.
Well, so I think we've had a very interesting discussion today. We've covered things such as, are banks really using innovation for the purposes they should, or is it really just a means for cutting costs? What's the impact of big tech getting involved in all that? And how can we really make sure that banks and fintechs alike are using the UK for all the resources they've got? Thank you, Charlotte and Simon, and to our listeners for joining us today. To find out more or to find our other podcasts, visit us at www.finastra.com or follow us on Twitter at @FinastraFS, joining in the conversation with #OpenFinance.